When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Nuance Dragon Ambient Experience, or DAX for short. This AI-powered ambient technology helps the physician be more efficient and reduce clinical documentation burden, because we all need that. To learn more about how DAX Copilot can help reduce burnout and restore the joy of practicing medicine, stick around after the episode or visit nuance.com/discover DAX. That's nuance.com/discover DAX.
Knock, knock, hi.
Knock, knock, hi.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Knock, Knock, I, with me, Dr. Glockenflecken, your one-stop shop for all things looking ball related. I'm so glad to get to talk to you today. I just had a rough day. It was fine. I was in clinic, and it wasn't a day I typically work, but I picked up an extra day just to, yeah. It doesn't matter why. I decided to work today, and it was very busy, and I was the on-call doctor. So I wasn't taking call, but I was the person that when people call in to the office with emergencies, I'm the first person that they get added to the schedule. All right. So that means that, you know, sometimes I end up with some pretty interesting stuff in clinic, and that's not bad. They're curveballs that you're thrown. And when you have a busy clinic already and all of a sudden you get one of those curveballs, all right, they can take some time to figure out. It'll put you behind in clinic a little bit, and that can make some other people upset, and it is what it is. And people need help, and we got to be there to help them. And so we always, in my practice, every clinic we have, like every half day, we have at least one spot that we reserve for same day add-ons. And I don't think everybody does that, but I think it's really important because we are a large practice in Portland, or one of the biggest. And so in Portland, there's a big metro area. And so things are going to come up, and I feel very strongly that we are available to not just our own patients to come in whenever they have a problem, but also the local urgent cares, the emergency departments, the primary care offices. I think it's about being a good community member to be able to have the space to say, okay, yeah, just send them right over from your urgent care over to the clinic. We'll work them in. We'll get them in. So we always try. We keep a couple spots for that type of thing, and usually it gets filled. And people have lots of eye stuff that comes up, and so it can make. I guess the point is, it can make for a very stressful clinic day when that's your responsibility. When something comes up, You just got to work it in. You got to work that patient in. You got to figure out what's going on. So today I was running a little bit behind, and you always get a little stressed when that happens. It was the day of diplopia. Diplopia. Even the word sends shivers down my spine. And so you might be wondering why. What's the diplopia? What, two visions? Two images. That's what it is. Diplopia. You see in two of everything. There's triplopia. There's quadruplopia. Is that a word? I think that's the first time I've ever said that. Anyway, those are less common, but diplopia, very, very common. So whenever I, you know, see a patient come in and like new diplopia, it kind of like a pit in my stomach, because, for a couple reasons. Number one, sometimes diplopia is hard. It's hard to figure out. There can be, it can be just an eye problem, which we'll get to, or it can be a brain problem. And you got to try to figure out which one of those it is. And if it's a brain problem, is it an emergency brain problem or is it a non-emergent brain problem? And so what do you do with that? It's so the decision-making is a bit nuanced and a bit challenging. And again, when you're trying to figure that out in the middle of a busy clinic and you're trying not to get behind, it can just be a bit stressful. So today was a day that I had more diplopia than I think any clinic should ever have. the neuro-ophthalmologists are going to be rolling their eyes at this because that's probably like half of their day is diplopia. But they see so much of it that they can do it probably faster than me. It takes me some time. I got to think about these things. It's a whole different way of thinking with the brain and the eye and the connection between the two. So what I thought we'd do today is do a little diplopia for dummies. How about that? Diplopia for dummies. And I'm kind of including myself in here. Like I know how to manage diplopia. Like I've been doing this. I've been in practice for 7 years now. So I got a handle on things. I can do this. But it's confusing to a lot of people, including people in other specialties, emergency medicine. People come in with double vision all the time. What do you do with that? I'm sure it comes up in primary care offices as well. So I thought I could just talk about it, and we'll try to simplify double vision. And this will allow me to just decompress from a busy clinic day where I did see a lot of double vision. And this will maybe be helpful for just the general public too, patients, people who may have double vision and you're wondering, oh, is this an emergency? Should I get this checked out? Should I go to the emergency department right away? Or should I just call my eye doctor that I go see? By the way, that's never a wrong thing to do. First, getting advice from your eye. If you're an established patient at an eye clinic, all right, they should always have somebody on call. Every ophthalmology clinic should have somebody on call. All right. If they don't, find a different eye clinic. Unless you're like in some like rural somewhere where there's nobody. I mean, you can't expect one person to take call like 365. Maybe that happens. I think it happens in my rural medicine videos. But anyway, the vast majority of practices out there should have somebody who can answer your questions on call. All right. And so if you're ever concerned, you feel like you're scared about an eye problem, like call your eye doctor if you have one. If not, you know, go to the emergency room. If you're nervous, if you're lost vision or you're seeing double and you're not sure what that means, hopefully this conversation will help you figure that out. But you know, it's better to be safe than sorry in a lot of these things. And the emergency department, they get a lot of eye problems that come through there. And if they can't figure out, they get me on the phone and I'm happy to help. All right. So let's take a quick break and then we're going to get into diplopia for dummies. All right, here we go. So for a long time, I felt like a dummy trying to figure out diplopia because again, the neuro thing, the two hardest subspecialties in ophthalmology, pediatrics and neuro-ophthalmology, can be very, very challenging. All right. So the first thing and the most important thing I would say is the history. Most of the time, honestly, in ophthalmology, when I'm triaging something or I'm listening to a patient tell me what's going on with their eyes, or I'm listening to the emergency physician tell me what they see, I can figure things out usually just by history. And so that is especially true for diplopia. So the biggest thing to try to figure out, all right, anybody with double vision, is it monocular or is it binocular? In fact, when you call me and you try to get me on the phone, tell me about a patient, and you say, this patient has diplopia, what do I do? First thing I'm going to say, is it monocular or binocular? What do I mean by that? That means when the patient covers an eye, does the double vision go away? When they cover the other eye, does it go away? If the double vision always goes away when they cover one eye, then that is true binocular diplopia. That's the kind of diplopia that we get excited about on call. Excited is a relative term. Our ears perk up a bit because it could be some serious things going on. All right. The other thing is monocular diplopia. So what am I saying? Monocular. So that's, we're going to set aside binocular diplopia for a bit because that's the bigger topic. Monocular diplopia would be the patient covers their left eye and they're like, oh yeah, I still see two or three images. It's still, oh wait, let me blink. Oh, okay. That's better. Or it kind of comes and goes. All of those things sound like monocular diplopia. All right. They cover the other eye. Yeah, I still see it. Oh, there goes two images. Oh, let me blink. Oh, I close my eyes. I blink a little bit. It gets a little bit better. You know, just I had it this morning, but now I don't see it anymore. The severe causes, the dangerous emergency type things that cause double vision, they typically don't just fluctuate like that. Okay. And certainly they don't go away. Or they don't persist, I should say, when you cover an eye. All right. So, and think about that for a second. That makes sense. Like if you're having double vision, it's because each eye is seeing a different image. The eyes are not aligned perfectly like they should be. So you're seeing, each eye is seeing a different image. Well, if you cover an eye, you're going to get rid of one of those images. So you should just see one if it's binocular. All right. That's the severe form. That's a potential for serious brain stuff going on. But if you cover the eye and you still see two or three images, well, then you know it's not a brain thing. It's got to be something in that eye. So that's monocular. It's that eye has some issue that's causing the patient to see multiple images. Another way of getting at whether it's monocular or binocular is asking about the nature of diplopia. Say, okay, when you, this is what I say with the patient all the time. All right, they're sitting there looking at me. I'm like 5 feet away. And I say, okay, do you have double vision now? Like, yeah. Okay, do you see two of me? Do you see two separate images of me or the screen or the mirror or the faucet? Are there two completely separate images or is it a ghosting of images? Is it like it's just barely starting to separate a bit and then you blink a bit and it gets better and then it starts to separate again? So I use the term ghosting because that's very typical for monocular diplopia. People, oh yeah, they're like, yeah, you know, it is. Yeah, it's kind of like ghosting. No, I don't see two of you. You don't have two heads. You're just kind of blurry or a little ghosting, all right? That's monocular diplopia. And the reason that is such an important distinction to make is because monocular diplopia, once you make that diagnosis, you're done. You're done. Because that's not an emergency. That is 99 times out of 100, that is dry eye, all right? If the surface of the eye, the cornea, if it gets dry, then you have these dry spots, it's going to just spread the images. It's you're going to get scatter of images. You're going to get diffraction, all this crazy optical aberrations. And the patient can interpret that as double vision, as ghosting of images. Okay. So again, 99 times out of 100, it's dry eye. The other time it can be random things like the lens is falling out of place. It should be right there in the center of the eye, but for a variety of different reasons, trauma being one of them, that lens can be what's called subluxed. It can move, it can migrate. And so it's like you're looking just through the edge of the lens. And so you can get a little double vision that way. There's things like epiretinal membranes, which is like a little kind of like scar tissue in the back of the eye that can cause you to have this kind of ghosting type image. But most of the time, it's going to be dry eye. Those other things are also easy to diagnose with a fairly straightforward exam. And they're also not typically emergencies, right? So that's something that, monocular diplopia, yeah, why don't you just follow up in the clinic with an ophthalmologist, all right? They're happy to see you. And you also don't have to do imaging for those types of things, for those types of problems. But certainly, because the workups can be pretty extensive when you get into binocular diplopia. So if you're ever not quite sure, just call your on-call ophthalmologist, all right? Trust me. Like, we're just sitting around. I don't know. Just give us something to do on call. It's okay. All right? You can call us. We're happy. We'll help you. We'll help you out. All right, so that's monocular versus binocular. Very, very important distinction to make. You guys getting excited? Are you excited already about this? Oh, man. We're about to get into the meat of the issue here. Oh, boy. All right. And a couple things that I saw today. Today, you don't know when, remember? I'm keeping it vague because of HIPAA. I don't want you to know what day this is. You don't know when I'm recording this. Maybe I recorded this like 3 weeks ago. You don't know. Maybe 2 days ago. Who knows? No one knows. Only I know and my producers. Anyway, okay, so binocular diplopia. All right, with binocular, we know there's a misalignment to the eyes, right? Because each eye sees an image. Normally, the eyes work well together and you see one image. But if something happens and one eye kind of starts going, doing his own thing, all right, all of a sudden you see two different images and you get double vision. The eyes are not aligned. This can be one of two different places can cause this. Something happening in the brain, all right, because of all the pathways, the neuro pathways that lead to the eye muscles that keep the eyes working well together. Or it can be a problem in the orbit, the space behind the eye. All right. So think about those two different places, either the brain or the orbit. So let's start with the orbit because that's less common. All right. So the orbit, things like orbital fractures. We've talked about that. All right. Orbital fractures can't, if you get entrapment of an extraocular muscle, that can be a PANS patient. That could be a PANS patient. But so an orbital fracture where you have a trapped muscle that causes the eye to not be able to move up or down, you can get double vision that way. So orbital fracture is one thing. And remember, entrapment, that's a PANS patient. Get that ophthalmologist on the phone. There's other things like thyroid eye disease. So thyroid is, and this is a whole topic that we're going to do at some point. Okay. I promise sometime soon, I'm sure. It's a big topic. It's a big, so I gotta steel myself. I gotta prepare. I gotta mentally just get ready for that because it's a big one. So the orbit, any kind of pathologic process happening in the orbit can cause the eye to be slightly askew. It can push the eye forward if there's like a mass back there that's pushing the eye forward. Because remember, the orbit is an enclosed space. And so you have something in there that's taking up that space that's going to move things around. It's going to push the eye in a particular direction. And when you do that, all of a sudden, the eyes don't work well together. All right, so a mass in the orbit of like a glioma, there's like a lacrimal gland tumors, tumors of the muscles in the eye. There's all kinds of stuff can happen back there. There's also non-cancerous tumors like an orbital varix, which is like a big dilated vessel that can push the eye in a particular direction. Thyroid eye disease is probably the most common orbital cause of double vision, of diplopia, because you get these big, thick extraocular muscles that cause the eye to be pushed in a particular direction, and they don't work well together. You get double vision. All right, so thyroid eye disease is a common cause of orbital binocular diplopia. All this terminology, it's painful. I'm sorry. Also, just inflammation. If you get inflammation back there, there's a disease called idiopathic orbital inflammation. That's very descriptive, isn't it? It's like there's inflammation in the orbit. We don't know why it's there, but it's there. I know. And you just try to treat it. Now you put some steroid back there, see if it helps, or systemic steroids. I don't know. That's a whole other topic in and of itself. All right. So thyroid, masses, inflammation, orbital causes of binocular diplopia. All right. Let's get to, I know, the moment you've all been waiting for. All right. The brain causes of binocular diplopia. So these are your nerve palsies. So remember, in order to keep those eyes working well together, you got to have those muscles working exactly how they should. Well, what happens if the muscles stop working how they should, or they temporarily get disrupted for some reason. So that can happen when the nerves that innervate those muscles, they lose blood flow, or they're damaged in some way. All of a sudden, you don't get that innervation to the muscle, the muscle stops working, and all of a sudden the eye can't move in a particular direction. That's what's going on there. Stroke is another thing. Obviously, if you have a stroke in an area of the brain where those nerves pass through, that can cause double vision. And of course, there's like other less common things. All right, we're going to stick with most common here. So how about the most common nerve palsy that we see? A sixth nerve palsy. We're doing cranial nerves now. We're really getting into it here, you guys. All right. Cranial nerve six, the abducens. It's a cranial nerve that just innervates one muscle. All right, there's a couple of those. I don't know why, this cranial nerve, it's very spoiled. All it has to do is innervate one little muscle, and sometimes it can't even do that correctly. So what this muscle does is it's a lateral rectus. It moves the eye out. So out like this, left and right, left and right. So if you lose function of that nerve, then it makes it to where your eye can't go out. And so you end up with an eye that's kind of turned in a little bit. What's what we call an esotropia. Eye is turned in. And then you have the patient look in different directions. This is a very important part of the exam for double vision, is having the patient look in all different directions. Up, down, left, right, all around in a circle if you want. I don't know. You don't do that. I don't even do that. But you can. It's kind of fun, especially with kids. Makes them a little dizzy. And so you have the patient look in all different directions, and all of a sudden, oh, wait, the patient's right eye is not going out. And then their double vision gets worse when they look at that side because that eye is not going out. All right. That's classic of a sixth nerve palsy. So like most of these nerve palsies, the question is, okay, I think I got a nerve palsy here. I think that's what's causing the double vision. What do I do? How do I work it up? When do I get an MRI? That's the big question. Do we get neuroimaging for this? So here you go. I'm going to make it easy on you. Sixth nerve palsy, which is, by the way, the easiest nerve palsy to diagnose. All right, this is when you get an MRI. If the patient is under 50, if they're any age without vascular risk factors, where they have a history of cancer, or they have any other neurologic deficits. All right, so let me give you an example. This is the most common person that presents with a sixth nerve palsy. 64-year-old patient with history of high blood pressure, borderline diabetes, diet and exercise. That's all they're not taking any medications for it. Comes in with a sixth nerve palsy. Does that patient get an MRI? If that patient showed up in my clinic, I would not order an MRI for that. Because it's well known that vascular risk factors like diabetes, like high blood pressure, like high cholesterol, predisposes someone to having a sixth nerve palsy. All right. So if you have someone who's over the age of 50 and they have vascular risk factors, I'm not getting an MRI, because we know that the reason for their sixth nerve palsy is because they lost a little bit of blood flow to that sixth nerve, that abducens nerve that caused malfunction of that muscle, and that over the next few months, it's going to gradually get better. And it does. All right. So risk factors, if the patient has vascular risk factors and they're over the age of 50, you don't have to get an MRI. If there's no vascular risk factors, really think about it. All right. So especially if they're young, because that should not happen. All right. I would say that's really the only, if nothing else, just if you remember that there's history of vascular disease and the patient's over 50, like you don't need to get an MRI. You can just send them to an ophthalmologist and let us decide. All right, let's move on. The fourth nerve. Oh, this is a tricky one. This is really hard. So the fourth nerve is the trochlear nerve. Again, a cranial nerve that only has to worry about one muscle. What a simple life. What an easy job. My goodness. I don't want to piss off a specialty. I was about to say the dermatologist of cranial nerves. But they work, you know, hard. The skin, it's complicated, the skin. So anyway, fourth nerve palsy, there's a specific pattern to the double vision. A lot of times people have a vertical diplopia. We see fourth nerve palsies very commonly in patients who have had trauma, head trauma. Very common to have a fourth nerve palsy because the pathway of the trochlear nerve, it's the longest pathway for any nerve. It takes its sweet ass time getting from the brain over to the superior oblique muscle. It takes its time. It is not quick. All right. And so because it's rather tortuous and has twists and turns and eventually it gets there, but it's more prone to injury with head trauma. All right. So it's not unusual. Like someone's in an accident, they come in afterwards, they have double vision. That's the diagnosis. Okay. So often these patients also don't get neuroimaging. I mean, they usually have neuroimaging surrounding the accident they have. But if I see a patient with a new fourth nerve palsy, similar to the sixth nerve palsy, if there's some vascular risk factors that I think, okay, this is just because of ischemia, their blood vessels are just a little tenuous, they've lost a little bit of blood flow to that cranial nerve, all of a sudden they have diplopia, I'm less likely to get an MRI. Now that being said, let me just preface that, the decision not to get an MRI, I will be seeing these patients back relatively frequently. And if the recovery from the nerve palsy is not as quickly as I would expect, or it starts to get progressively worse, because again, once you have the nerve palsy, it should slowly get better. It may not completely resolve, but it should slowly get better. If it's getting worse over time, over like 1 or 2 or 3 months, something else might be going on. Then I'm getting an MRI. All right. So if it doesn't behave like I would expect an ischemic nerve palsy to behave. Whew, am I confusing you? I feel like I'm confusing. None of you can't talk back to me. I'm not even looking at any of you, but I'm trying my best not to just torture you with this information. So anyway, fourth nerve palsy, when to get an MRI, there's a very low yield for any kind of, positive finding on imaging. So you don't have to image typically. All right. Let's move on to the big one. This is the last one we'll do, okay? The third nerve palsy. All right, this is what everyone gets so very concerned, understandably nervous about, is a new third nerve palsy. Now, let me tell you why. So the third nerve, it does a lot of things. It has some, it innervates more than one muscle. It actually does a significant amount of work, all right? Let's see if I can remember all these. It gets your medial rectus, your superior rectus. It gets your inferior rectus as well as your inferior oblique. It also controls the Müller muscle, which is the sympathetic fibers that go... Sorry, not sympathetic fibers. There are... autonomic fibers, the parasympathetic fibers that go along with the third nerve. God, I should have looked this up before. You know, this is the thing. Like when stuff like this comes up, I'm getting my book out and I'm reminding myself what these nerves do. it has some control of the eyelid. All right. So when you have a third nerve palsy and the pupil. So a third nerve palsy, this is what it looks like. Classic third nerve palsy. The eye is resting in its natural state. It's resting down and out. So your right eye is like angled out and a little bit down. Also, on that side, you have a droopy eyelid. Also, on that side, you have a dilated pupil. That is classic third nerve palsy. Now, you can really get into the weeds of ophthalmology. If you sit down for dinner with a neuro-ophthalmologist, which, by the way, always take that opportunity. If any neuro, if you, especially if you're an inquisitive person who likes to learn things, like the stories you'll hear from a neuro-ophthalmologist. But if you really get into it with a neuro-ophthalmologist, this is a hot topic. When do you image a third nerve palsy? All right. Especially in this day and age of trying to be responsible with our imaging orders. And so the quick and dirty, the easy answer, especially for non-ophthalmologists, is just image every single suspected third nerve palsy that you come across. And by imaging, I would say at least a CTA to look at the path of the arterial blood flow into the brain, because the main thing we're looking for is something that can kill the patient, which is an aneurysm, a perianeurysm, any kind of aneurysm in the posterior communicating artery. That's the classic location of this, but just any kind of aneurysm affecting the circle of Willis is the typical location. And so you can get into it like, well, if the pupil is spared, if there's no pupil involvement, but you have a complete third nerve palsy elsewhere except for the pupil, you don't have to, because the fibers for the parasympathetics run, you know, in a different part of the nerve versus the motor innervation fibers. You know what? Like, whatever. That's all great. And you're very smart if you can figure all that out. But I like simple things. I like simple explanations. I want to keep it simple. And so if you have a suspected third nerve palsy, just image. Just do it. That's how I approach it. That's how, because I, you know, the human body does weird things sometimes. The human body doesn't always follow rules. And I would want that for myself. If I had a definite third nerve palsy or a strongly suspected third nerve palsy, I'd be walking straight over to the MRI. All right. I'm not even knocking on the door. I'm just walking in, probably going to have metal in my pockets and forget it. And it didn't ruin the MRI machine, but I'm putting my head in that thing and I'm getting myself an image. All right. Third nerve palsy. Just do the imaging. And a lot of times that's easier to do when the patient comes in emergently, right? I mean, I don't want to put too much pressure on those emergency physicians, but if you can get an MRI while they're there, great. If not, at least a CTA to look at the blood flow. And then the last little tip I will tell you before we end, is always check GCA labs. So we've talked about giant cell arteritis. This is a vascular disease that can kill a patient. All right. It's almost exclusively seen in people over the age of 60. So if you have a patient over the age of 60 that shows up with a cranial nerve palsy, always check for GCA. That means getting an ESR, CRP, CBC, platelet count. Always do that, because that is one way that that giant cell arteritis can present, is with cranial nerve palsies. All right. Keep that in mind, particularly a sixth nerve, maybe less so with the other nerves, but sixth nerve, for some reason, I don't know, maybe it's the pathway of the nerve. Neuro-ophthalmology can weigh in on this, but just check it. Just always check cranial nerve palsy over 60, check GCA labs. All right. Your don't do that eyeball tip of the week is don't forget to check GCA labs in a patient over 60 with a cranial nerve palsy. How about that? How about that's your don't do that eyeball tip of the week? Maybe I should start doing a do that eyeball tip of the week. That would have made more sense for that one. Do that. Do that. Check GCA labs. All right. Check monocular versus binocular. All right. Check an MRI whenever a patient comes in with a third nerve palsy. All those things. Those are your big takeaways for today. Thank you all for listening. That's it. That's everything you possibly ever wanted to know about diplopia, and I'm happy to oblige. Thank you to my producers, Shanti Brook, Rob Goldman, Aaron Corney. I'm doing this by memory. I don't have it in front of me. Our editor and engineer is Jason Portiza. Our music is by Omer Benzvi. Knock Knock High is a Human Content production. Let me know what you think about this episode. Did you learn a thing or two? Can you tell me if you learned a thing or two? I want to know what you learned and whether you're going to retain this information. All right. By the way, I'm thinking about trying to get some CME going for all those medical professionals out there. I know you love the CME. You got to have the CME. I'm trying to figure out how to do that. It's like a process. And so I don't know. We'd have to cut out the ads. We'd have to do some editing to figure that out. But I think I want to do that for you all. You've all been with me this whole time. Let's get some CME going. People have asked. Hell, you're teaching us about eyeballs. Why don't we get a little bit more out of it? Get some CME. Keep our licenses. I'm all for that. All right. So I'll work on that. Tell me what you think. Give me some content ideas, some topics you want to hear about eyeballs. And yeah, I'll see you next week. Take care, everyone.
Goodbye.